Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Juliana Hatfield, whose new album, Lightning Might Strike, is out December 12th on American Laundromat Records. The album finds Hatfield reflecting on life, mortality, and how we sometimes find ourselves not so much living the life we've planned, but instead living the life we've been handed. That's Juliana Hatfield on Into Music, coming up now. I was really struck on this collection of songs. It was like, you know, this is about one of those things, I guess, moments in life where we kind of maybe know that some of these things are inevitable, but then they hit us and we kind of go, what? Is that kind of a fair assessment of this collection?
I think so. Yeah, I think it's trying to come to terms with certain things in midlife, you know, and it's like, in a way it's about midlife disillusionment. But for me, I think I was born disillusioned. So it's not as if it's a huge change in my perspective, but I was definitely trying to come to terms with some things, and I had a difficult year. Yeah, definitely grappling with these things. You know, like even certain kinds of trauma don't necessarily really, you don't really understand them until later in life, or you don't really, it's all, you look back and you realize a lot of your life has been a blur, and you didn't understand how early things that happened early in life are affecting you all through your whole life. So yeah, I think you pretty much got it, pretty the idea.
I guess as I get older, I've come to realize that sometimes it's like, you know, because I think we're trained to think like things like grief and so on and so forth, there are these immediate things. And I've learned over time, it's like, sometimes I can experience grief for something that happened 10 years ago. And it wasn't that I was like, intentionally numbing myself. It's just, it didn't happen then, you know?
Yeah, you can't control it. I mean, one of my best friends and favorite people died about, I think it was about a year and a half now, or maybe even closer to two, but sometimes I think it hasn't really even hit me yet. Like I don't know if I've even really started grieving. You know what I mean? It's like, I almost feel like it hasn't really hit me fully yet. What a big, huge, momentous thing his loss was to me. Cause right after that happened, my dog died. And in some ways the dog's death was, it hit me harder in that moment because the dog was with me every single day. And it was just like, and my friend was not with me every single day. So it was like just the physical absence of everything about the dog was more of an immediate everyday day to day absence in my life. So yeah, grief is funny, and it's mysterious, and it moves at its own pace.
Yeah.
Or not. Maybe some people never really grieve. It's too difficult. They're too blocked or something.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think that's entirely possible. Yeah. And the death thing, that's interesting too. Like, in my little friend group here in Wichita, we had a close friend pass a year ago. And on the anniversary, I said something to one of my friends and he said, no, it can't be a year already, you know, because we still had that thing of like, oh, this guy's just he's going to walk through the door, you know, any moment.
I know, it's so bizarre. You'll have a dream a year later just of the person, and it'll be like a visitation, like, oh wow, that felt so real and so intense, and oh yeah, he's not here anymore, and why did I dream about him that night, you know, where did that come from?
Yeah, it's so mysterious, and so I'm curious, like, as you're going through this, I mean, you've been writing songs, you know, for many, many years. When you're going through things like this, you know, the death of a friend, the death of a pet, family illness, and so on, is there ever a time where you're like, I don't know if I can ever write about any of this? Or is it like, thank God I have songwriting to express some of these things?
The latter. It's the latter. I don't consciously think, like, oh, I'm not going to be able to write about this. It's too painful. Because I always know that writing about stuff helps me in some way. It's just like an instinct. It's like breathing or eating. I write songs about what I'm thinking and feeling. And it's my way of, I think it's my way of just coping with disappointments and with pain. A lot of pain I've written about, and just the weirdness of life, and all the things that it's hard to talk about or hard to express in conversations, I just always write. I think that when difficult things happen, the songwriting is it's kind of a relief in a way. It lets me quote unquote process things, I guess, not always consciously. Sometimes I listen to a song years later and I it's almost like I hear the song for the first time years later, like, oh wow, I was dealing with something, maybe not fully consciously, but I was writing about it half unconsciously, and sometimes it's like a kind of therapy for me, I guess, just talking it out with the universe or with myself, knowing that I'll be communicating something to other people who will hear it eventually, and knowing that I live a pretty isolated life, but the music is some kind of a form of communication, and I know that it's gonna reach some people, and some people understand it because we're all basically the same, and people have the same kinds of experiences and emotions as humans. Deal with them differently.
Do you remember, like, the impulse to write songs? Like, did it just show up one day?
Well, yeah, it was there. That impulse was there from very early on. My mother tells me that when I was a little kid, a little child, she'd be driving, I'd be in the car, and I'd look out the window, and I'd just start singing about what I was seeing outside the window. I would improvise songs about what was out there, what we were passing by. And so it was just this instinct or impulse to sing about what I see, how I see it. And then more formally, I wrote a full song probably when I was about 9. And so, there's one that I remember being the first one, but so yeah, I don't know where that it's like anything that anyone has a knack for or a desire to do. Who knows where it comes from? It's just the way I was wired, I guess.
Were your parents nurturing of that?
I would not say that my parents were nurturing in the way that they parented. They were more very laissez-faire in the way that a lot of parents were back then. There was no helicopter parenting back then. I was, as a child in the 70s and 80s. And, but they were supportive. They were cautiously, quietly supportive of what I wanted to do, which was go into music. And I think that they were privately kind of worried about how I would make my way in the world as a musician who was very shy and not very communicative as a person. I think they worried about how I would make it out there. But they were supportive. They're like, they never told me not to do it, not to pursue it. They always came to see me play, and my father collected every single press clipping and put it in a notebook, and he was fascinated by the whole scene of the music business that I found myself in. And they both were amateur musicians too. My mother started out on a path to being a professional concert pianist. She went to the University of Michigan, was studying piano there, which she, at some point in the middle of her studies, she decided it was too difficult and too competitive of a life being a concert pianist. So she switched over to journalism, and she became a journalist. And my father and my mother both played piano in the house, and my mom taught some piano on the side, and she taught me at first on piano. My dad liked to play ragtime music, and my mom played a lot of like Bach and Beethoven and stuff like that. And they both sang in church choirs. So there was definitely a lot of appreciation for music in the household.
That's fantastic. Yeah, and the helicopter parenting thing is so funny because sometimes I'll tell younger friends of mine, I'm the youngest of six, so by the time that I was, a teenager, if I ever got in trouble or anything, my parents were just kind of like shrug their shoulders and say, "Well, you didn't die." And
Exactly. Yeah, it's like, I think that it's a miracle that we survived our childhood, me and my brothers and friends. And even the dog, we would put, the dog would go outside in the morning, like, see ya, and then the dog would come back for dinner, like maybe all covered in mud or something. Maybe went down to the low tide, and we were fine. Who does that now? Who lets their dog out and without any kind of electric fence or anything, just lets the dog out for the whole day? No one does that anymore, unless they live on a farm or something. But sorry, I think I interrupted you. But sorry, I think I interrupted you. But
No,
you're
no,
right.
no. That was just it. Just that struck a chord of like the different time that we're in.
Yeah, it was very different. And in some ways, it was, in some ways, I feel sorry for kids today. Kids today, no, but at the same time, I don't know. It was tough sometimes, when we stepped on a rusty nail or something. No, stepped in a lot of dog dew. Remember stepping in dog dew? That never happens anymore. We'd go out in bare feet in the summer, and no one picked up the dog dew back then. Just stepped in it
Yeah.
all the time, constantly in the summer.
But that's so great too, because I mean, just that idea of like being able to have an imagination and express it. And I think that's another difference too of time, where today people might be more in a hurry to kind of shape something, like, oh, my kid's making up a song, let me post this out in the world, as opposed to just letting the kid make up a song and have that for themselves.
Yeah, I imagine that's a lot of pressure on a kid, the whole side of it, that is being seen and heard all the time. Like, as soon as you have an idea, you're posting it. And so there's no t like I was saying earlier, that sometimes I'll hear a song of mine from 10 years ago, and it'll hit me for the first time, almost as if for the first time, like, wow, that's what I was saying. I didn't even realize what I was saying. And it took I needed a lot of time for the song to just sort of sit and stew inside of me before I could really hear it. And but today, it's like everything's just immediately thrust out there into the public. And I mean, who knows? I don't know if that's bad or good, but it's definitely a different way of living in the world. There's not as much private time to sit and stew with your ideas, unless you're actively disdaining the technology. Now you have to make an active effort to pull yourself away from all of that. being seen and being heard. Because
Yeah.
we're all being seen and heard and monitored constantly.
Oh, yeah.
Even, yeah.
You mentioned being kind of living kind of a solitary life. Sometimes I feel like I feel like a little bit of solitude. It's almost for me at times, it's almost a way of kind of protecting my creativity because I have to turn inward, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Oh, for me, solitude is like medicine. And not just creatively, but as a person, I need it's like when solitude recharges me. And I know there are people who feel the opposite is true for them. Like they don't like to be alone. They need to be with people, but I'm not always the opposite. Solitude, being alone rejuvenates me. And I think that's maybe part of why I turned to music, because making music is very so a very solitary pursuit for me when I'm writing and recording. And that, I guess, I just it's part of why I have the video turned off for this interview. It's like my the fewer senses I have to use. Is that me? Oh, sorry. The fewer senses I have to use at one time, the more I'm able to concentrate on whatever task I'm trying to do. Like if I'm writing, when I would be in the studio mixing, when I'm in the studio mixing a song, I find myself, I put the headphones on my ears and then I put my hands over my eyes. And it's like I can hear better when I don't have the distractions of sight. If I can't see what's in front of me, I can hear things better. I could hear the mixes better. And it's like talking to you with the video turned off. I like to think I could think better and string thoughts together, but I'm not sure if that's true. But now I forget what we were talking about.
Oh, just the, you know,
Oh,
the set.
solitude.
Yeah, solitude.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of distractions out there, especially now. Distractions everywhere, and it really makes me feel so confused and scattered if I'm out there and there's all just like all the lights and whistles and bleeps and the onslaught of everything and being alone and the quiet. It's good for me. I feel like it's salutary and not a bad. Some people think solitude that's a pejorative, but it's good. I think it's a good thing.
It's you know, not to share too many anecdotes, but I remember being a kid in school and one of my teachers saying, "Oh, you know, you don't want to be a loner." And I was
Oh,
like,
that's a terrible thing for teachers to say.
"I know." And I was like,
Or, like, think of all the creative geniuses who are loners.
"Yeah."
But come on, yeah. And what did you feel when you heard that?
Oh, I felt I absolutely felt a little bit ashamed because I was like, I like my alone time, you
I
know?
know, like whole, it that's just part of the whole. We were in public school.
Yes.
I think public school, or at least when I was growing up, it seemed like public school was it was there to teach you how to to teach you how to be a drone in the workplace. Really, wasn't so much about I wasn't in the great it wasn't the greatest school that I went to, but yeah, I remember just like falling asleep. First of all, you have to start way too early. The kids are too tired. They're making them wake up too early. And then so I'm falling asleep in class while I'm trying to be listening. You're supposed to be listening and learning, and that the brain is just not awake yet, and it's horrible. But you're learning how to be tortured throughout the day and how to withstand the torture of being there, and then you're trying to conform to all the roles and all of the curricula, and taught to join in and not be a loner. But all the loners are the ones who are creating the great masterpieces of literature and art and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And that's I credit my father with early on. I think that he kind of tried to teach us not to respect authority just because they're in positions of authority. And that was a great lesson for me to learn. So I never had any automatic respect for any grown-ups unless they proved themselves worthy, including my father. I didn't respect him when he was being a jerk, and I knew not to just believe anything any grown up said to me, because they didn't know what they were talking about, and I could see that. My father taught me to think for myself, which was a wonderful gift that he gave me.
Well, and that leads me to will probably be my final question about the song, My House Is Not My Dream House. And that to me ties together a lot of what we're talking about, which is this thing of like, my life doesn't necessarily look like the expectation of somebody at my age or my, standing in the world or whatever. But whatever it is, it's my life. This is where I'm at, and I'm going to make the most of it, you know?
Yeah, while complaining about it, I'm dealing with it. Yeah, we're dealing with it, right? We're dealing with it. But I think that's part of the lie of the American dream. It really is. It's part of the indoctrination that all the systems are trying. They're trying to indoctrinate us into certain ways of thinking, ways of believing. Like the American dream, it's not going to come true for everyone. It's just not, and it's a silly dream anyway to begin with. At the even just the idea of home ownership, it's meant to be this wonderful thing that everyone should be striving toward, but it's not for everyone. Some people should be renters. It works better for some people renting, or home ownership, it's a, not for it's not necessarily everyone's dream, but everyone feels like I the part of the song is the idea that, well, the subtext is I felt like I was kind of meant to own a home at this point. By this point in my life, I should be a homeowner, or I felt like I was starting to feel like, there's something wrong with me. I'm not really fully mature. I'm a loser if I don't own a home. So I felt this pressure coming from outside of me to try to buy a house. And I did it. I did that thing that we're all supposed to do. And it was disappointing. It was a slightly disappointing reality, which is fine. I'm sure it's disappointing for lots and lots of people, but you don't hear so much about that.
You've been listening to a conversation with Juliana Hatfield. Her latest album, Lightning Might Strike, is out December 12th on American Laundromat Records. You can learn more about Hatfield at her official website, julianahatfield.com. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org. And find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. This is an excellent time, as always, to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torin Anderson. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.